Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly conversation on New York State government and politics. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Hi, this is David Gustina, producer of The Capital Connection. This week, we present a special conversation between our host, Alan Chartok, and U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara. Alan and the U.S. Attorney sat down earlier this week for a wide-ranging conversation, which we present to you now.
Mr. Bharara, I have a question for you.
I hope you have several.
It is the same question, the same thing we say here in radio. And it, you once said the two most famous words in Albany, which were, stay tuned.
And I didn't invent that phrase, by the way. They use it on TV, Batman.
Exactly, stay tuned. So are we still staying tuned?
You should always stay tuned, at least for the next 32 minutes.
Can we expect more of the same?
Look, as I've said a number of times before, we have a lot of prosecutors in our public corruption unit. We have investigators who support them. We have FBI agents who work along their side. And we're not closing up shop anytime soon.
So there was...
That's not explicit enough.
Yeah, it's explicit. Pretty explicit.
I would write it out, but we're on radio.
Do you have any interest in public office yourself?
So let me put it this way. Given that Bruce Springsteen is in town, I was not born to run.
There are people who say, well, you know, this is the last year that you have because there'll be a new president, and then the new president appoints the U.S. attorney, but we know better.
The new president could like me, too.
Well, most of us who taught political science a long time ago know that the senior senator of the same party gets to pick the U.S. attorney for the most part. So I'm assuming if a Democrat wins, you could be here for 8 years if you wanted to be.
Why don't we wait and see what happens? You can invite me back.
Okay. Once a year, okay. So how long do you want to stay in this position?
I think it's the best job that I've ever had. It's the best job I will ever have. I think the only thing I ever wanted to be when I went to law school was to be an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. And people don't get this, but the job of a prosecutor is not to stock up convictions and notch victories in his or her belt. It's to do the right thing. It's to do justice. It's to make sure that you bring cases that are righteous and you walk away from cases that are righteous to walk away from also. And there's very few people, especially in the law, whose job it is to wake up every day and think, how can I make the world a little bit better, a little bit safer? And if I ever don't believe deep in my mind and in my heart and in my gut in a case that we're pursuing, then we don't pursue it. And that's a nice way to go to sleep every night. So why would anybody want to leave a job like that?
Let me ask you about this. We know that in the case of Skelos, we know that in the case of Silver, they were personally enriching themselves with their relatives. But there's this other whole area where people collect $16 million for a campaign fund. And obviously, nobody gives you money unless they want something back for it. Is that something that interests you?
Look, everything interests me. I have wide-ranging curiosity. But we're a criminal prosecutor's office, and we can only bring cases that the law allows us to bring. And, you know, famously, people have said that this, you know, the scandal, I'm sure you hear this a lot in Albany, the scandal is not what's illegal, it's what's legal. And, the folks seated to my right from the good government groups probably have a lot more relevant things to say about campaign finance. If people follow the rules and give money in the way they're allowed to give money, then there's nothing that my office can do about that. That's up to other folks.
But of course, if you find out that somebody gave money specifically with a promise to get something back for it, that would be different.
It's a higher burden to prove that a contribution, an otherwise lawful contribution, was given specifically for a particular official action. You have to prove that. That's often a difficult thing to prove.
Well, you have been pretty successful at expanding, what people assumed could be done, the concept of taking a law and expanding it.
Well, I don't think we've expanded any law. We've used the law as written, and maybe there have been folks who have not been as industrious and hardworking at connecting the dots. or following the money as the brilliant, hardworking prosecutors who work in my office, but we didn't expand one thing. We took the law as it came to us. The law required us to prove quid pro quo, and we proved it. Now, you know, in the Silver case, in the Scales case, just because you dress up a bribe or dress up a kickback as a legal referral fee, you know, doesn't make it so. And we proved that that's what those were. And a jury, two juries, unanimously of 12, found that quickly in rapid succession.
Do you think that was because people are just sick to death of the political
culture? No, I don't think so at all. There was one commentator who suggested that, and I said about that commentator that he wasn't in the courtroom, he didn't listen to the evidence, he didn't deliberate, he didn't bother to maybe even read the charging instrument. The summations in both of those cases were very powerful because the evidence was very powerful. And, you know, one thing that I hope people understand is when we bring the cases, we bring cases that we think are, you know, where people have galloped over. We're not trying to criminalize politics. We're not trying to change what the rules are. We're saying if you are taking bribes and kickbacks in exchange for official action, for example, in the case of Dean Skelos, you know, repeatedly engaging in official action or threatening the withholding of favorable official action so that his son could get a no-show job, well, that's a crime. That's always been a crime, and we'll prosecute it as such. And what people also don't appreciate is there was a lot of evidence in both of those trials that showed what was in the minds of the people who were being prosecuted. You know, we were up on court-authorized wiretaps of some phones being used by Dean Skelos and his son. And if you go back and recount the evidence, there's clear evidence that they knew what they were doing, and they knew what they were doing was wrong. You know, there was the one phone call in which Adam Skelos was talking to, and this was played at trial, so it's all publicly available information, in connection with a court-authorized wiretap call, where Adam Skelos, at a time when he and his father became concerned that there was some scrutiny on the part of federal officials and out of my office, that it was hard to talk on the phone. And he calls up his father, and he expresses his frustration about not being able to talk on the phone freely about their thing. And he says, I believe, you know, it's very frustrating. It's like effing Preet Bharara is listening to every effing phone call. Like that one.
We have a lot of DAs. We have a lot of DAs, good ones, who do on the state level. We have an attorney general. Why does it take the federal government to do this?
Well, I think they are great DAs. I'm friends with many of the DAs in my district and in other districts. I just spoke at the New York State District Attorney Association conference in New York a few weeks ago, and I think they have brought good public corruption prosecutions and others. I can only speak for what my office does, and I think that historically, long before I got there and long after I leave, that we have you know, the best, most enterprising, aggressive prosecutors around who work with the best, most enterprising federal agents around.
So the CNO poll said 89% of New Yorkers think corruption is a serious problem. So now that you've done the work you've done, should they feel better?
They shouldn't feel worse. Yeah, look, how often is it the case that 89% of the public agrees on anything like that, on any issue? I believe that same poll also said only 4% of New Yorkers thought that my office has gone too far, which is an I think more people think that the earth is flat. It's an astonishing consensus. And I hope that over time, people feel better about it. I mean, there was some criticism somewhere that I read suggesting, well, with Bharara's office bringing all these cases, it's making the state legislature in Albany look bad. To which my response was, what's making the state legislature in Albany look bad is the state legislature in Albany. I mean, the same thing was said about insider trading prosecutions that we brought. And what you hope is over time that people can rebound in their faith a little bit because they think that there are cops on the beat, that it's not a one-off thing, that it's a sustained effort, and that over time, better people are drawn into the process. The bad people leave the process, either in handcuffs or otherwise. And people get hope again that you can have a culture in your government, whether it's in Washington or in Albany or anywhere else, that people can be proud of. And they're really, I want to repeat again, because I know with the newspaper reports, are all going to print the bad things that I said. There are really good people in the legislature, and you hear their voices. By the way, you hear their voices more, I think, recently in the last year, as I think more and more people have learned it's okay to speak about these kinds of things. It's okay to be defiant about these things, not necessarily in the way that Teddy Roosevelt was, but it's okay to do that. And I think over time, if you remove the worst miscreants from the legislature, you encourage the people who want to make things better in the legislature, you give voice to the people like these fine folks to my right in good government groups, that the net result of all of those things happening together is people can feel much, much better about their government. That's my hope, at least.
So how do you incentivize the legislature to do what they don't think may be in their own immediate interest?
Well, I have a particularly blunt incentive.
Well, that's been around for a while.
And that's the avoidance of prison. But for other people, I think, you know, look, if people are thinking about their institution in a way that hopefully they were thinking about it when they ran for the positions, and they're thinking about the respect of the institution, then hopefully that incentivizes them. Because the better the quality of the person who is running for the position, the more likely he or she is going to be to want to do the right thing by the public. I also think that there can be, you know, a decent amount of, or better amount of, self-policing at that level to incentivize people. And hopefully over time, people want, you know, like everyone else here, people want to work in a place that folks are proud of. And people come to work in my office, not for the money. They could all make more money elsewhere. These are the top law students in the country come into my office. And they leave literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on the table. And they come to work there because they're really proud of the place. And they're proud of the way they get to serve the public. And so we attract not just bright minds, but good people. And I think every government institution can aspire to that, whether it's the United States Senate, or it's a U.S. Attorney's Office, it's a public school, or it's a legislature. And you want to make sure that people are saying that kind of thing over and over and over again, as opposed to, these are trumped up charges, he should remain in power. Like that's not the culture you want.
There's something called the iron law of oligarchy. You get a lot of people sitting in a room. Sooner or later, one person, I don't want to say one guy, but one person ends up running it all. How do you stop that from happening? Because, you know, somebody wants
You're asking me increasingly complex questions about...
Yeah, well, it's not my fault. This is all coming from the good government groups. It's not my fault.
Look, I mean, what you do is, I think, and maybe this sounds idealistic, but I think a little bit of idealism would be good for a change here, is you have to make sure that everybody at the institution has an independent operating mind and brain and gut, so that at least somebody, when in the face of overreaching or in the face of despotism or in the face of corruption, will say and rally people, you know, to the opposite side and say, this is enough. We can't tolerate this. We can't go along with this. And you have lots of institutions. You have lots of bad things that have happened in human history, much worse than the kinds of corruption that we're talking about here, because you didn't have that countervailing force, because people didn't stand up, because people didn't have the courage. Maybe they weren't taught it. Maybe they didn't have it to begin with. But part of the reason that I say these things to business students and young people in particular is you want them to remember when they go to a place and they see bad things happening, that they do. I mean, it sounds simple, but it's obviously really, really hard to be a whistleblower or to go against the tide. Look, there was evidence at our trial, very sad, about, and you alluded to it earlier in a question, about what happened to people who dared to challenge the leadership. Well, look what happens to the institution overall when people year after year after year learn the lesson of challenging power in an appropriate way is oblivion. Well, over time, if enough people stand up to that, then it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, you're a student of all of this, Preparara. Tell me this. There's a big call now for a constitutional convention, you know, to change the ethics laws and change the way that we do things. Based on your reading of the Constitution, remember what you had to do to bring your cases and everything else, do you think we should have such a thing?
That's up to the people of New York to decide. I understand that it's a difficult set of obstacles and hoops to get through to have a state constitutional convention. But generally speaking, I think it's not a terrible idea. If people can reopen and relitigate some things, because there's some things structurally, perhaps, in the Constitution that don't make a lot of sense, one of which, I'm told, is that it's difficult to change the law with respect to whether or not an elected official can maintain his or her pension even after being convicted of public corruption crimes lasting years and years. That's a constitutional matter. I think it's not a stretch to say that might be an interesting thing to change and fix. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, you know, I think it's up to other people to decide. I don't know it well enough to understand what all the other upsides or downsides would be.
Well, personally, I'm a little concerned, not that you care, but...
I care deeply,
yes.
Alan.
I'm a little concerned that politicians who get themselves elected to the legislature also have a cousin, Louie, who'll get elected to the Constitutional Convention.
That may be. I haven't investigated the cousin Louie situation.
Yeah. I love it. Okay. So now, do you believe in structural changes like the amount of years that a legislator should be allowed to serve?
Look, again, I'm a prosecutor. I say more than some prosecutors. I may have a personal view on some of those things, but I don't have all the facts. I don't serve in the legislature. I don't serve on a committee that is making recommendations as to what kinds of changes should be made that would lessen corruption. I don't presume to know that. When it was my job, when I did serve in the legislature, I presumed to know it, even if I was going to get it wrong. But I think there are a lot of things for people to consider. And my role in talking about this stuff is simply to point out our experiences and to show, based on evidence that we have seen and the trials that we have undertaken, what some of the hardships are in being able to prove things, what some of the hardships are in being able to ferret out the good behavior from the bad behavior, and some of our sense of why it was easier or less easy for certain people to commit crimes. And so when you talk about, as a matter of common sense and based on our experience, intense concentration of power over a long period of time, and we didn't need our prosecutions to know this, to know that that is more likely to give rise to a situation in which, in an atmosphere in which, the people who aggrandize all the power to themselves and kept it for a very, very long time are more likely to commit crime and to get away with it. That's, standard operating human procedure. But it's just borne out in the cases that we have talked about. And there are legislators in many contexts who serve admirably and honorably for decades. And I understand the argument. I'm not giving you a cookie-cutter answer. I understand the argument that, well, why should constituents be robbed of expertise and clout in Albany or in Washington, if their representative is honorable and hardworking and great? And that's a decent argument. There's also an argument to suggest that that's the exception rather than the norm. And overall, for overall justice and for an overall good political system that is most likely to cause the most amount of justice for the most amount of people across a city or a state or a country, that you have to enact those limits. That's a reasonable argument, too. I mean, I would have to look at all those things and consider them. I just think that what we have to offer through the evidence and facts relating to our cases should be part of that debate and part of that discussion among the people who are actually the ones who have some say about it.
The always brilliant newspapers and pundits have said again and again that you were looking at Governor Cuomo during this time and that you were particularly furious about the Moreland Act Commission.
I don't get furious. Do I seem furious?
Yes. Yeah, and I'm getting out of here. Yeah. That the dropping of the Moreland Act Commission was a disgrace, and you picked up the pieces and you went and you looked at all of that. And then finally you said, and this is a little problem between the Albany Times Union, which said one thing and which we've been told that there wasn't enough evidence to indict the governor. That's the quote that we were treated to. And then I read the ATU this weekend and said there was no evidence. Could you set us straight on that?
Yeah, I don't have my statement in front of me. I could recite it to you, but I wouldn't say anything beyond what I said in the statement that we released a couple of weeks ago.
And so you're sticking
with
that?
Believe me, I'm sticking with the statement that I made, yes.
Yeah, but just so for my limited capacity to absorb, that there wasn't enough evidence.
I believe the phrase we used, I have folks in the back, was there was insufficient evidence.
Insufficient evidence. Okay. And what role does the governor have in fighting corruption?
I think everybody has a role. The people in the audience have a role. The good government groups have a role. The legislators have a role. In some way, prosecutors have a role in bringing the cases they bring and educating the public and increasing awareness in an appropriate way. But anybody who is in a position to consider the factors and consider the evidence and who is, based on his or her position, to enact reforms that might make things better, I think has a special responsibility, and that includes anyone in our government who has the ability to propose legislation, pass legislation, modify legislation. I think everyone has a strong responsibility in that regard.
Now, one thing that has been suggested for making the legislature more honest is to raise their pay, and I'm wondering whether you have a view on whether or not that's...
I'm going to disappoint you again. Mm-hmm. It's reasonable. It's not crazy for people to suggest that you take away the possibility of outside income a little bit because of what our cases showed, that if you have this unlimited ability to have outside income, you can hide bribes and kickbacks more easily. On the other hand, it's also reasonable for people to say, you know, why don't they earn the money that they're getting paid now? I think it all depends on overall, you know, what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, at some point, if public corruption becomes such a problem that people care about more than other things, then that's how you decide how to make your trade-off, right? That is it worth paying them a little bit extra to take away this temptation to make so much extra that they're compromising their decisions about the things that affect all of your lives? I don't know that we're there in New York, but we could be there in New York.
Hmm. Interesting.
Was that an appropriately circuitous answer to your question?
So if you were me, what question would you ask next?
You could go back to asking me how much I love my job. I don't know. I trust you to ask the questions.
Okay. The media. Let me ask you very quickly. Are we doing our jobs?
A lot of you are. So there's a problem with the media, which I say often has a role to play. The politicians themselves have a role to play in self-policing. Prosecutors have a role to play in getting rid of the bad apples as appropriate. The public has a role to play because they choose who to elect. They can choose to have a constitutional convention if they want or not. And the press. Now, the best use to me, given what I do at the moment, is investigative journalism. And there are cases that we have brought in the public corruption realm and otherwise. I know people appreciate this. Literally get started because we open up a newspaper and there's a great columnist at some paper or investigative journalist who writes, there's this bad stuff happening over here and it seems credible. We open an investigation. And that's a remarkable thing. You know, a free and open press can almost do as much, maybe, and in some cases more, depending on the circumstances, that any prosecutor can do to shine a light on things. And part of what we care about, it's not just holding people accountable, which is important, but exposing the truth. You know, journalists and prosecutors and investigators share a number of interests, and one of those interests is the truth. I'm happy, for example, that in some ways, this might sound an odd formulation of it, but you'll understand what I mean, that Sheldon Silver and Dean Skelos went to trial, and they didn't plead guilty. So everybody could see all the evidence that we had, and everybody could see how the system was betrayed, and everybody could see how the oaths were violated. And that's an important thing. And so when folks in the press take a gander at some problem, you know, public mischief especially, that's a great service to a lot of people on its own, because sometimes if people have some, you know, shame and self-respect, they may alter the process, they may alter their practices. The side benefit is sometimes it opens up a criminal investigation for us. My worry is, and I've said this before, my worry is that the state of journalism being what it is and the impossibility of turning a profit based on old journalism especially affects, as far as I can tell, especially affects investigative journalism generally, because that's a very expensive proposition. It takes a lot of investment. And even more importantly, affects sort of small-town investigative journalism. I don't think you have as much of a problem in New York City where there's a million reporters, but there are a lot of places throughout New York State and the rest of the country where paper after paper closes down, or an investigative unit that had six people and it could look at whether or not, you know, the local plants were, you know, giving us good water, or whether there was lead poisoning here or there. All these bad things that happen, often the people who are sounding the alarm bell first are the journalists. But as the industry and the economics of journalism change, I worry about that.
Unfortunately, we'll have to leave the discussion because we are out of time. I would like to thank our co-sponsors for today's event, Citizens Union, the New York Public Interest Research Group, Common Cause New York, the League of Women Voters of New York State. Thanks to all of you for filling the Linda, and WAMC Northeast Public Radio's Performing Arts Studio for this event. All the seats were claimed in less than one day. Most of all, let's thank Preet Bharara, the U.S. Attorney for Southern District of New York. I'm Alan Sharkar.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.